Welcome to Jewish History with Rabbi David Katz, connecting the human side to Jewish history. For sponsorship opportunities or to support this podcast, please visit our donate page at www.support.rabbidavidkatz.com.
Hi, it's Monday morning, and I want to do the third part of the Moscato, which I've been talking about, and I even have some follow-ups and things like that. It's funny, as I mentioned before, because of some recent events, so some sponsors are interested in this, but I want to dedicate today's, which I'm going to talk about, Yehuda Moscato's famous commentary on, the most famous commentary you never read, on the Kuzri, and this is for being sponsored by Gideon Miller and family, Gideon and Navin family, out in Houston. Not only had he sponsored this, but Gideon's turning into my best guide on how to get the necessary articles from the internet, because as I mentioned before, a lot of interesting research has been done recently. I myself didn't know it. Interviewed a Moscato, different aspects of him. Even though I always know it's a very rich topic, but I also know that he's been covered rather superficially, in my opinion, over the years, because that's what people do. Unless you thoroughly, you know, research something, go from the safer from beginning to end, you know, with a fine tooth comb. Most of these people do, like Israel Batan and the other, they just like skim it. I can tell, I know what they do, and, you know, and just come up with some glittering generalities, which sometimes may hit the mark and sometimes not. So, thank you, Gideon. Now to get down to business, as I say, our hero, who I told you, I'm going to remind you, was ready to do Yarag Val Yavar, wrote the and published the Nefutzes Yehuda, which is the classic among the Jewish darshanos, although it's very heavy. And what I'm saying today is going to have to do with that all in Futsi Yud as well. But in addition, much more well known, I think, is his Pirush on the Kuzri. That itself is already a story. Because as he tells us, he was approached by three rabbis in Venice. And they said, you know, make the Kuzri more open to the public. You get what I'm saying? In other words, write a Pirush on it that'll make it easier to understand. Because the Jewish classics, without the right pirish, are usually pretty dense, right? They don't have to be, but usually they're pretty darn dense. And he has this very flowery intro where he says, you know, he compares himself to Avraham Avinu and the three angels are the three rabbis in Venice, you know, for Esa Eina Vera, he knew Shlosh Anam Nitzavim Alai, Shlosh Agonim, Victor Ravafaltzadil, and Yehuda Suriel. These were big names in Venice, big rabbanim, term malchem there, like malachim, and the bottom line is im no matzanuchim beinecha al no tavor al das chavirecha yukach no maat mayim v'rachetz sichlecha v'ishon tachas ho'etz lahag deletz l'hafli toshia. Right? So it's very flowery, which is wash your mind, put yourself in a good thinking mode, and compose a pirush on the Kuzri. Now, it's just interesting because this is in the late 1500s. I think you probably know this, many of you. I would say, in my opinion, because that's all you ever get, the Jewish philosophy interest, such as to the degree it's there, has always been divided, I think, between the Mernevuchim and the Kuzri. Okay? Those are interested in philosophy. A lot of people not interested in philosophy, but I get it. You don't have to be. Especially by modern day standards, this stuff is like outdated, a lot of it. But you also have a lot of diamonds and nuggets in the outdated stuff. Which is why I think people, and I don't mean just mean, you know, academic scholars, they're interested in old, out-of-date stuff. But regular people do, even nowadays, you know, not a lot, will go either in Mernevuchim or the Kuzri. I think much less the other books. I ain't heard of any Chabura doing Emunas V'Deis HaSadigon,
for example. I don't know if there's any chaburas doing, you know, Sefer Ikrim, which is a heavy read. But you do hear people that do Mar Nebuchim or make chaburas. I was in Muncie last year and they had a chabur in the guy's house from people. And you definitely hear of class in the Shiurim and the Kuzari. They represent two different ways of thinking, I would say. And the Mor Nebuchim got more play in the Middle Ages because the Rambam was a bigger figure than Yehuda Levi. That's just who he was. Yehuda Levi was a poet. The Rambam was the Rambam. And even though, as I said many times, just about all the controversial stuff you find in the Rambam, surprisingly, he's not from the Rambam. He's not the one in the Mechadesh. You already find it in Sadi Gona and the Chovos Halavos, I would say. The vast majority of his Chedushim. But the Rambam put it in a certain way, and that's how people heard of it. And, you know, that got the notoriety. And, as you know, already from early on, the Rambam started to have these Mefarshim. Some to the right, some to the left. We've talked about that. So you get to any edition of what I call the Rambam Mikras Gedolos, you see the big four, you know, the Eifodi and the Usher Kreskes and the what's the name, Profia Duran, you know, that's the Eifodi. The Barbanel, and I forget the other one. The point is that, and you know, the famous line, one's the Chacham, one's the Rasha, Tom, any day Elisha. Well, we've talked about that. Shem Tov is what I'm thinking of. Shem Tov, Shem Tov, we talked about him. So when you see, like, for example, now, today, it's coming out very recently, a whole big project in Israel, to put out a very beautiful, readable edition of the Mor Nebuchim with the four, you know, with the four Chachamim. In nice big print, not Manukkah, unfortunately, but, you know, everything else. And they came out with the first volume. You must have heard about this. And it's going to make this stuff more available to the public. And there have been plenty of other commentaries on the Rambam that didn't get into the Mikras Gedolos. You know, Moshe Narboni and all these other guys, you know. Okay. Now, by contrast, the Kuzari, which was written before the Mor Nebuchim. Mor Nebuchim was written in the late 1100s, and the Kuzari was written in the early 1100s. Mor Nebuchim was written at the end of the Golden Age of the Jews in Muslim Spain. The Mor Nebuchim was written after the Golden Age was over, and the Rambam and his family and others had to flee and run away to Egypt and places like that in order to stay Jewish. So they were two different mahalos. And the Frum world, the Yeshiva world, has always favored the Kuzari because, among other things, this is Aristotelian philosophy. Not entirely, but fundamentally. And, you know, his famous line is, the rabbi says to the king, you know, we believe in what we believe because of history, because of historical experience. In other words, either there was a Maimon Har Sinai or there was not. We believe that there was, that our fathers are telling us the truth. If there is, you philosophers figure that out. Get what I'm saying? Don't tell me it didn't happen because it doesn't make any sense philosophically. If I empirically see something, you can't tell me it's not possible that I saw it. You know what I'm saying? Unless you tell me I was illusional, but if it's 600,000 people and more, then you can't say it's illusional. And therefore, delusional, and, you know, it happened. And I don't have to worry about, you know, what the Aristotelian take on that is. And that's always a much more firm kind of attitude, as you know. And therefore, I would say the firm world in general, certainly today, maybe in the past, has always liked the Kuzari. Plus, he has that healthy racism, meaning he says Jews are superior beings, superior types. There's regular people in the Jews. Rambam does not believe that at all, but I'm saying the Kuzari. And when the Jews were persecuted as they were so heavily in the old days, and to some degree they're being under attack as I speak right now, makes a person feel good to say, no, not only are we not, you know, the guy who tells us we're inferior, we're disgusting, we're this, that, and the other, Adrabah. You know what I'm saying? Adrabah. We're the children of Avraham Yitzchak, and Avram was the choicest descendant of Noah. You know, the whole Kuzari line. Right? A certain type of racism in a positive way. And so people always like that. I repeat, think, for example, off the top of my head, if you're a Jew living in Italy, in the years I've been talking about, it's a couple hundred Jews at the most, surrounded by Velta Catholics. They're always down on you. You're only depending on the prince or the duke to protect you. Yom of Elilah, you hear from the priest that you're junk and you're disgusting and this, that, and the other. I mean, how do you keep your kids within the Machne just from a psychological basis? I mean, right now, as I speak, Jewish kids in America, particularly in colleges and universities, are under tremendous verbal attack, and it's making effect on them. You hear Israel's terrible. They stole the land. Zionist is. Israel did the massacres on October 7th. Whatever lies they say, it hits your kids. And you have to have intestinal fortitude. How do you not go along with that stuff? And you see a veld of Jewish kids and adults, I'm sorry to say, you know, are siding with the bad guys. They're marching for the Hamas. The Hamas did the terrible things. You know, they've been overwhelmed by the verbal attacks. So one of the ways against the verbal attacks is to, you know, counterattack. Now, in liberal America, I don't think the Kuzri will go over, but I'm talking about the old days. So, surprisingly, as far as I'm aware, the Kuzri came out in the early 1100s. And it was translated eventually, you know, it was in Arabic, like most of that stuff. It was translated not long after by Yehuda ben Tibbon, who lived in Provence. And I think there weren't any Mefarshim on it. Now, it is easier to read than the Rambam, but it's still not a totally easy read. No, he doesn't go into, you know, like the Rambam, the 25 Aristotelian arguments and all that business. But it's not an easy read. It's a fairly dense text, at least in many places. Not the beginning, but after that. Now, mind you, the Kuzri is a great read. In other words, Yehuda Levi knew how to write. He was a great poet, of course. But it's not so pushy. Consequently, it circulated, I think, in manuscript. It wasn't published until it hit Italy in the early 1500s. That's just interesting, because Mer Brooklyn was published earlier. And when it hit Italy, so you can understand that this would appeal in the Hebrew translation of Yehuda ben Tibbon, which is like all those old translations, they're just you know. So you know, the kind of dense and so forth. So it would be very good for an Italian Jew that you're the master race and you're the superior one and this and that and the other, you know, and you're from the best of the best, literally, and so forth. Avtzalachas alagoyim, Am Yisrael Chai, yeah. That kind of approach. I get that. But on the other hand, not many people can read it. Now, if you're Hebrew educated and you're a Yehuda Moscato, no, you're a member of the elites, and you can read very well, you could crack the book if you want to. But wouldn't so push it. On the other hand, it was a good antidote. Again, I'm just telling you my opinion. To the anti-Semitism and anti-Judaism, you hear all the time, Yom Valila, in Catholic countries like Italy during the Counter-Renaissance, Counter-Reformation. So, you can understand there was an objective need to make this more of a popular work. The Kuzri is not a popular work. And to the best of my knowledge, I don't think that anybody ever made a kitzur of a Kuzri, which would have been interesting. And so you had the classic text of Yehuda ben Tibbon, because, I mean, the Jews in Italy, in places like I couldn't read Arabic. Hold on for a second.
Oh, yeah, yeah, I just had some major phone call about some personal problem somebody had. All right, what was I talking about? The Kuzri in the Renaissance Italy. Well, what I was going to say is like this. So you can understand the attraction of the Kuzri with its message, and especially doubling down on the moon and all the rest of it. And by the way, he converts to Geisha King, you know, the rabbi does the chover. So we find that the Kuzri started to get published in the 1500s. I am sure that one group that really was interested in this were the Muranos who ran away and escaped to Italy. And so they, you know, going through their own experiences of having suffered, living a double life and now trying to live a Jewish life. And a lot of them have questions. Am I making the right choice by leaving the Catholic and switching to the Jewish? You know, a lot of them, you know, were conflicted. And you read the Kuzri, it's like a shot in the arm. You know, I mean, that's just normal. So it was just an interesting time to live. Now, having said that, the translation of Yibin Tibbin is not Pashut. It's very old and wooden, which is why today, in modern times, we have a whole host of new translations of the Kuzri, right? Into better Hebrew. Nothing wrong with that. So I didn't know this when I was young, so I used to plow through the old Kuzri and all the rest. I didn't even have the Kudos. Later, I discovered that there was an edition of the old translation with the Kudos. And you can do it if you want to. But look, you know, I've had a pretty good Jewish education. Not everybody has. And so today in America, if somebody came to me and says, I'm interested in reading the Kuzri, I'd tell them, get the English one from Kropotkin. That's a better translation. It's modern American English. There is an old one that was made around 1900 by Hartwig Hirschfeld. You remember that? He used to teach in the Jews College. That, again, that English translation is as wooden as the Ibn Tibbin. So just to crack the text is not pushing. Okay? Just to crack the text. That's why Rabbi Kropotkin made a newer one into modern English, which is at least, you know, you can understand in American English. In Hebrew, there's a famous translation from Yehuda Ibn Shmuel, you know, Kaufman, and it's Manuka too. That's why I got it years ago. And it's a lot better because it's broken up into paragraphs. And ever since then, I've been a little bit of a Kuzri freak over the years, hot and cold. And I have one, I'm holding a bunch of them in front of me. Madur Menuketetim Tamsis Mevueret. So in other words, Yehuda Ibn Shmuel, I don't think was from. So the Frumis don't want that one. But what do you call it? It has like little paragraphs, explanatory paragraphs in front of each and every paragraph throughout the book. So that makes it easier to use the old one, the older translation. There is, again, a very yeshivish type, really excellent one from this Rabbi Ganizi, or something like this. Also, Menuketet, in which he gives you sort of like that thing they have in the Chosal Vavas type. You know, where they put it into modern Hebrew. But a very straightforward, normal modern Hebrew. You know, in other words, yeshivish, normal Hebrew. And, you know, on one side is the Ibn Tibbin text. On the other side is this stuff, Menuchot again. Explaining, putting it into, I think that's the best one myself. Makes it easier. If somebody was asking me and was like, yeshivish guy could read the Hebrew, that would be the one to use, the one from Ganizi. I also have one from, Rabbi Kapach. So it's going to be obviously the most accurate, or you think it'd be the most accurate translation, because it's got the Arabic on one side and the Hebrew on the other, the same way Kapach did all the other classics. His Mor Nebuchadnezzar is much well known, but the Kuzri, not so much. But again, you see on the left-hand side, is the Arabic in the Hebrew text, meaning the Yehuda Levi, like the Rambam, wrote in Judeo-Arabic. And the other side, Rabbi Kapach's, you know, modern Hebrew translation. And he was a giant Talmud Chacham and all the rest of it, knew Arabic. So obviously, that's going to be the general one if you look for accuracy. I could be wrong. I'm not the world's expert on this. I have one from Professor Shilat. Also, again, it's a new translation from the Arabic. It probably is a little more accurate even, right? And for me, it's broken up visually into paragraphs and the kudos and all the rest of it. And again, it's very machbid on getting the exact translations. It doesn't matter that much. You know, only if you're a real freak and you want to do, you know, like a paper on the Kuzri, you want to, you know, depending on specific points. All right. Those are all new. Everything I just read you, which I have, like, you know, because I'm into that kind of stuff. So that's all new. If you live a couple hundred years ago, it wasn't around. All you had was the old Yehuda Ibn Tibbin one. And there weren't mefarshim on that, the way the mefarshim popped up on the Mardavuchim. And so, therefore, you find that our hero, Rabbeinu Moscato, who was number one renowned for style, because they knew from the way he writes the Hebrew, and second of all, he knew the Limud Chol, so he could supply that part when you see that in the Kuzri. Well, the Kuzri is not really that much into that, but it is to some degree, as I'll explain. And so he yielded to the entreaties of friends, and he composed a long pirush called Kol Yehuda on the Kuzri. If you get the old-fashioned Kuzri without any Nekudas, what I call the Kuzri with the Mikras Gedolas, indeed, you'll find the way they used to publish it in Eastern Europe was that you have the Kuzri on the top, and then at the bottom you have two. You have the Kol Yehuda from our hero. You have the Utzer Nechwen, which is, in some respects, better, actually. The only thing is, the Otzer Nechmad was published, was put together, composed by Yisrael of Zamosh. Zamosh is a town in Poland. I had guys in my shul from Zamosh. And the thing with Yisrael Zamosh is, he's the Rebbe of Moses Mendelssohn. So that already freaks out the Frum. And, you know, I can understand that. And the result is that even though the Otzer Nechmad from Yisrael Zamosh is actually, in some respects, a better pirish. If you're talking about just a straightforward pirish, to explain the words, I'll tell you what I mean in a minute. But, you know, depending who you are in Eastern Europe, you might say, I guess I don't have anything to do with Moses Mendelssohn, like, even though it has nothing to do with Haskell or anything whatsoever. Yisrael Zamosh was a fun guy. He was a Moscow in the very, very beginning of the Haskalah movement. He was a totally frum guy, and he was a big Talmud Chacham. Believe it or not, he actually had shalos and shubas and things like that. And, you know, he was, as I say, a Moscow in that sense of the word, which really stuck out like a sore thumb in Eastern Europe in the 18th century, but okay. And I'm laughing because he wrote other Purushim as well. I'm holding in front of me now one of the editions I have of the Chavos HaLevavos. I like to get the different editions and stuff. That's my Mishagas. And there's one that's very yeshivish, Mishnas HaSefer. You've probably seen it. And it's a two-volume thing on the Chavos HaLevavos. Okay? Now, again, we're talking about the Chavos HaLevavos of the old Pirish, again, from Yehuda ben Tibbon, right? And that's also been considered a hard one to crack. That's why in Israel they put this Tiva Levana, whatever they call it, Tiva something or other, that the yeshiva guys use, which is fine. There is a Kapach edition of the Chavos HaLevavos as well, and others. But I'm looking at this very yeshivish set. There's two volumes with Mefarshim at the bottom. Everything Menucha. At the top is the Chavos HaLevavos. At the bottom they have three Pirushim. One's called Paslechem, one's called Marpil Nefesh, and one's called Tov HaLevanon. And the Tov HaLevanon, which is a pretty good one, right? You see it on every page of this edition, right? I mean, it's really a deluxe edition with footnotes and helpful things on the right side. Anyway, guess who it's from? Habir Hashem Tov HaLevanon, Merav Hagon HaMafursam, Rabbi Yisrael HaLevi Zal, Baal Otzer Nechmet Perish HaLakuzri, about Sefer Netz Yisrael and Masech Des HaShas. They don't tell you he's the Rebbe of Moses Mendelssohn. Right? So that's how it works in Israel. Yeah. Now, because of this, I'm sure, I remember as a kid, long ago, I don't know how long ago, I remember long ago, I saw, it used to come out in Israel, maybe some of you remember this, it used to come out like a kuzri, like in tan cover or something like that. Can't remember exactly. It was just the Kuzri at the top with the Kol Yehuda at the bottom. That must have been Israeli yeshivish. They didn't want to have the other guy, Otzer Nechmad, because he was associated with Mendelssohn. And, you know, he had the long Kol Yehuda, because Yehuda Moscato was considered a frum guy. Now, what's really funny is, both of these people, Yisrael Zamosh and our hero, were big maskilim. They were also frum. But Yisrael Zamosh was a Moskil at the wrong time. No, at the beginning of the 18th century, when the Haskalah movement that started in Eastern Europe
took a left turn for some of them and became Epicursus. There are many for people who did not become Epicurus. I've said that 100 times. But on the other hand, there were many that did. So he ends up, you know, smelling bad because of bad associations. Other Rosh Hashanah. But Yehuda Moscato, who nobody knew, they said some rabbi in Italy, they didn't know. They probably figured it's a Sephardi, you know, Moscato. They're not Sephardi at all. Moscato's name of a place in Italy, we think. Nobody knows exactly what it is. And I got an email the other day. Listen, I have all kind of listeners, and I'm not making fun of anybody. But he said, is this guy Yehuda Moscato, is he the one who started the wine, you know, the Bartonur Moscato wine? I had to say, actually, that's that's a 21st century business. No, he did not. It's a little bit funny because the Jews in Italy had issue with wine. They used to drink Stam Yenim. I think many of you know that. There were big controversies about that. But I'm pretty sure if it's Yehuda Moscato, he probably was real from me. He didn't. But many of the big Gedolim did. But that's a separate shmooze. Now, the Kol Yehuda is very interesting because, for several reasons, it ain't a regular Pirish. In other words, that's why I say the other one's better as a Pirish. Which, for me, the reader, ordinarily, if I'm interested, me, myself, and I, if I'm interested in reading the Kuzri, and, you know, the back and forth between the king and all the Kashas and the Terusim and the dialogue and so forth. So I'm basically learning the Kuzri. Let's say I did it with Chavrusa. We're learning with the Kuzri. When we have something that's not easy to understand, you try to look at the Rashi at the bottom. That's the Otzer Nechma. That's the Maskilah guy. He kind of tells you, at least in my experience, what the text is saying. You understand? He's trying to supply what the text is saying. When he makes some references to the philosophy and things like that, I mean, he tries to explain it very simply, straightforward. Now, I'm going to contrast that with the Kol Yehuda bar Yehuda Moscato. He, to my mind, he clearly treated the Kuzri, I would say, the way the Beis Yosef treated the Torah. In other words, he's definitely commenting on the text, but it's just an excuse to do his own thing. Because when you see the Kuzri, a lot of times, for example, the Kol Yehuda will disagree with the Kuzri. He said he made a mistake here, or this, or that, and the other. Which he's entitled to do, but that's not what you figure the regular reader is interested in. Meaning, he couldn't bring himself, and this was published after he died, so maybe he would have changed it if he would have been alive and published it himself. It's an extremely interesting book of a certain variety, which I don't think would appeal to most readers nowadays. First of all, he's using it to make his own points, which is legitimate. And, you know, he does explain the text sometimes, but he has very long discourses on all kind of other stuff. And the reason is, he had this wonderful secular education. And he shows it off all the time, and I don't mean that in a bad way. He tries to use all these many references from Greek and Latin sources, from the philosophers, Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle. I mean, really. And many others, and Quintilian with the rhetoric, and Cicero, to make points. They're always from. You get what I'm saying? No, he's always using them to make a from point. And he's like using, you know, backing it up with the secular stuff. But meanwhile, comes a whole long discourses on his own ideas. So it's okay, but what I'm trying to say is like this. In my opinion, you don't learn the Kuzri with the Pirsha of the Kol Yehuda. You learn the Kol Yehuda with the Pirsha of the Kuzri. If you're interested in the thought of Rabbi Yehuda Moscato, and there you see a whole ganz of philosophy of its own. Now, to tell you the truth, it's not a turn on to me, and I'll tell you why. First of all, I'm not a philosopher. I'm very serious about this. Historians are not philosophers. They're natural enemies. They're epistemological enemies. I've said that 100 times. Second of all, the Kol Yehuda is from the Renaissance. Most people think that when you talk about philosophy, you're basically talking about Aristotelianism, the way the Rambam was. And, you know, the Ralbag and people like that. How do you square what the Torah says on one hand
with the teachings of Aristotelian science and philosophy. Today, nobody believes that, but he did at that time, as you know. So, okay. So when I'm reading the Rambam's Amor Nebuchim, especially with the Mikras Gedolos, as I call it, they're trying to work out, you know, the philosophical side, the scientific side, as we would say today. And, you know, you read the Mepharshim there, each one's commenting in his way. And so you had a whole set of Aristotelianism, which dominated Western culture and even Islamic thought for many centuries during the Middle Ages. But that's Aristotle, that's one guy, and his Talmidim. But there was also Plato, who was much less known in the Middle Ages. And Plato is a whole different world because he has a theory of the ideas, you know, the basic idealistic philosophy. You know how it works. There's a thing called book. If I say the word book, you think of a certain surah. And if you show individual books, they're just variations on that surah. Right? You close your eyes and think of the word book. You know, two covers and pages in the middle. That's the idea of book. But then there's a real book that I'm holding in my hands. So which is more chashuv? Excuse me. Which is more chashuv? So you say, well, you have an actual book. No, says Plato, you know, that book could be burned or destroyed. The idea can never be destroyed. You get what I'm saying? That's the Turin Homer thing. Now, I've never been good in Plato. I had enough trouble with Aristotle. I know a little bit, like a dummy, because in this area I am. So are you. And there's a whole sheet of Plato, Platonism. And then there were like people who expounded on his ideas called Neoplatonism. And this was really not known. The texts were not known in Europe throughout the Middle Ages. It was only in the 15th century when the Byzantine Empire went down the tubes and taken over the Ottoman Turks that some Byzantine scholars, because in the Byzantine Empire, they still preserved a lot of the Greek stuff, which never made it to the West. Only in the 15th century, they brought it to Italy, and to them it was like a new stream. You know, they've been stuffed with Aristotelianism over and over again. Now you have Plato, and he was also a Gvaldiga guy, and he brought Platon, because Hebrew, you can't say it started with a consonant, you know, so it has to be a syllable. Like Achashverosh is really Achashverosh, so Plato, a Platon. And you start to get his writings. Now, I'm not into them, but it hit Italy like, you know, the cat's pajamas in the 1400s and 1500s. And people really was into this stuff. And a lot of it is very similar to a Kabbalah. The idea of the emanations, you know. And it's interesting because our hero lived in Mantua, which is where, very controversially, in his lifetime, the Zohar was published, printed, which was a big controversy. I'll deal with that another time, maybe for the Gnosim. And so in other words, and the whole community is 1,000 people, 1,200 people. So he was majorly involved. He must have known the people doing it. No, just imagine the Hak was going on the Shul in Mantua when they're publishing the Zohar in Mantua, with permission of the Pope, by the way. Must have been a lot of Hak on that. But it seems to me that, you know, a lot of stuff sounds like a certain version of the Kabbalah, the type of thing you find in Irgas. You know, Tzimtzum Kipshuto, Tzimtzum Shelo Kipshuto. The world emanated from one thing out of another. Was there Chomer Rishon? Yeah, the Rambam says there's no Chomer Rishon. Has to be God, you know, create everything out of zip. Yesh Miayin. But you know, and the Rambam talks about this, by the way, that there are some Tanaim and others who believed that Hashem created the world out of his existing material. I'm not getting into that. You know, he says, you know, that's not what the right opinion is, but it's not a heretical opinion. And Plato would definitely be that way. These are issues of philosophy most of us don't even know exist. And in the 21st century, I don't think you have any interest in know exist, unless you're the type of guy, which I'm not, who's really interested in philosophy, number one, Greek philosophy, number two, and Platonic philosophy, and maybe the philosophy of Philo, of Alexandria, who writes in the same kind of way The reason I mention is Philo of Alexandria, lived in the time of Beis HaMikdash. He wrote all this Greek stuff. A guy wrote me all about it, a very nice essay the other day. David Campbell and the Lair House, trying to introduce the from reader, I guess, to Philo. But Philo, you know, is, and what's his name, Belkin, and YU used to be the big bucky in that. These guys are into this kind of talk. If you're interested in that sort of approach to Judaism, it turns you on, then fine, not me. So when you go through the Kol Yehuda, you see a lot of that. Because by his time, Platonism and Neoplatonism and mixing together a challenge with Judaism and Platonism and taking Nikudos from Platonism or Plato, also from Socrates, also, but also remember Plato did the dialogues, you know. He's a lot of stuff from that. So it's a strange peerish. I'm learning the Kuzri. No, I'm not. All of a sudden I'm off into Philo. Remember, he was the same, our hero, the same, lived the same time and same place as Azari de Rossi. And Azari de Rossi was the controversial Jewish historian. He was a Rav who wrote all about Philo. He didn't like him so much. I think our hero did like him. All of a sudden, we're having very non-yeshivish conversations. That's my point. And so I can't imagine a yeshiva guy in Israel going through the Kol Yehuda, and all of a sudden you see Quintilian, you see Philo, you see Cicero, you see this. Now, again, the ideas in them themselves are very interesting. And the mushals he uses are right. And he was a name dropper. That was called scholarship once upon a time. In the 15, 1600s, erudition, rather than chidushim, was apprised. You see that like in Menashe ben Israel's books. And the idea is, you go through this, you say, oh my God, this guy knew a velt. Because remember, he was a big Talmid Chacham also. And he may have been the Av Basin of Mantua by the time he finished, which is really something, Av Basin. So notice he was a Dayan on Basin and things like that. And at the same time, he's totally shaku in this world of Platonism, Renaissance philosophy. He know. By the way, he quotes also from Aristotle as well, not as much. And he admires Socrates, believe it or not. So did the Kuzri. There are places where the Kuzri talk that Socrates, in some respects, was an ideal figure. You don't find this in regular from literature. You get what I'm saying? Now, you find it in Italy. And because he was who he was, I think it didn't get out there in the from world that there's anything treif or something like that with the Kol Yehuda. And so, as I said before, it's written very good Hebrew. And, you know, there's never any question about what he's talking about. But each thing he takes about is he goes on his own excursus. He wants to do his own thing. Now, that's fine. But like I said before, that means that what you're really doing is learning the Kol Yehuda with the Kuzri is just an excuse. You can do that. But I don't see too many people doing that. And today, Platonic philosophy, you know, even though, like I say again, it does have certain things in common, it seems to me anyway, things in common with Kabbalah. So, especially the way the Kabbalah was received in Italy in his time from Yisrael Serug and all those guys. And you talk about the emanations, you know, from the Ein Sof and the Onam HaKadmon and all that other stuff. Which you find, you know, in Lubavitch, I mean, these are well-known ideas that Hishtalshalus, you know what I mean? That it reaches from, like you know, they'll say the Hebrew alphabet is ethereal ideas, which eventually become concretized in the ideas of the Hebrew letters, which eventually come further concretized in the actual physical letters written on the original Sefer Torah, et cetera, et cetera. So, yeah, that's a certain way of looking at things. We don't talk that kind of talk, it seems to me. At least I don't run across people talk that kind of talk today in the 21st century. The issues people have today about the Torah, about God, about truth and all that, I don't think, you know, the Plato stuff, you know, it ain't particularly nogea to them. Rather, you know, they're more into empirical, it seems to me, empirical stuff. That's why a lot of people don't do philosophy today, because when you do philosophy, it seems to me mostly what you're doing is the history of philosophy. What did the famous philosophers of the past say? They don't agree with each other. Now, you can't go exactly by me because I'm a historian. And like I said before, historians and philosophers are two different behemoths. Because a historian will tell you the historical context, like I'm doing right now in Italy. And, you know, here's Moscato, and he read these books, and he didn't know about this. And it's before, just around the time of Copernicus. And, you know, he knew what he knew, and he's quoted. I mean, the people he's quoting and using are names that nobody's heard of anymore. You know, Pico della Mirandola, Yochanan Almano. I mean, all, you know, these were big names in Jewish and general academic scholarship in the 1400s and the 1500s. Today, only specialists write about them. It's the same thing in the other book also, in the Futsis Yehuda. You have a lot of very interesting ideas, but a lot of them, to me, are going to be unusual simply because they're based, like I said before, on Greek and Latin, you know, ideas. Now, I'll say it again. He's very from, right? And they're always used in service of a from idea. You know what I'm saying? So the Kol Yehuda is its own experience. So if you're prepared to roll up your sleeves, I was saying do it with a chavrusa. And so I'm going through the Kol Yehuda per se. I'm using the Kuzri just as to give me an idea of what the Kol Yehuda is talking about. That's a limud. If that turns you on, that's a limud. And, you know, he has an unimpeccable, he's not the Rebbe Moses Mendelssohn, let's put it that way. He has an unimpeccable reputation. And I told you before, nobody even knew about the Hargul Valyavrasa. He was a mamisha from guy. He was a hero. But his world of ideas is not our world of ideas. His world of ideas was, Platonic, Neoplatonic, Renaissance. It wasn't the... I get the impression that, you know, by the 1500s, they were upgestopped with Aristotelianism. Like, the heck are they doing this for centuries after centuries, you know? Genugschein. And they're looking for something new. And eventually found it in the Plato. Now, given another 150 years, and they're already bored with Plato, and they start looking for modern type ideas. So you have the philosophers, you know, Spinoza, and then Leibniz, and all these other guys. That's the way the mind works. Things that were, you know, popular at one time are not popular another. Now, I'm doing what a historian does. I'm dissing the whole thing. Right? I'm saying, you believe this because you live in this time, this century. Which is true. Which is true. So, I'll say it again. If you want to read a remarkable work, you'll learn about the Kuzri because he, like, agrees and disagrees with him on every other page. And he puts a certain spin on it, the way the Yehuda Levi didn't. So it's like learning, you know, I guess, Tosas on the Gemara. That's not a good example. But it's an unusual kind of pirish. And he meant L'shem Shemayim. There's no question, when this book came out in the 1590s, the Italian Jews were under the heavy pressure of the Catholic Church, which did not let up. And it was, as I say, the Counter-Reformation, the Catholic Reformation, part of which was to persecute the Jews and majorly diss Judaism. It's an era when a lot of Jews in Italy and a lot of towns had to go to churches and listen to conversionary sermons. It was just hard to be Jewish. That's what it was. I told you, I was in Ferrara, and they showed you the street where the Jews had to run through a bunch of Goyim who beat them up on the way to the church on Sunday morning. They had to go in order to listen to the sermon. That was the law by the priest. And, you know, the Jews would try to block their ears with wax, and the Goyim would cash on. It was a whole long night, so it wasn't easy to be a Jew in Italy. So you can, there's no question in my mind that these rabbis in Venice, who were Talmidei Chachamim, they weren't into all this philosophy stuff. That's not who they were. You had many rabbis in Italy with all this fancy education. That's true. But you also had regular, you know, Dayanim, as we would say today. And, you know, there are, what do you call it? Simone Lezzato wrote a whole book called Socrates. You know, you had all these types. But their idea in general was always to help. And you can see that these guys would say like this, we need someone who can make the Kuzri available to Hamunam. And so they gave it to Yehuda Maskatza. Now, in my personal opinion, he did not do so, because he had so many ideas of his own, me, myself, and I, that it became his own work. So I can't say it became what they really needed was like a Rashi or a Kahati, so to speak, on the Kuzri. You know, that's what I think people needed, if you're into that. But, you know, people who are very great and very distinguished, a lot of times they can't be machnia themselves to simply be a tuffle to the Iker. To be a Rashi is a remarkable talent, or a Kahati, or whatever you want to call it. You know, that's a talent, how to subordinate yourself to a text and leave your own stuff out there and just tell me what the text is saying. He couldn't do it. At least that's the impression I get when I read it. He couldn't do it. And so the result is he produced his own. The Kol Yehuda was popular for a while. I'm laughing because, you know, by the time yeshiva guys read this, 19th century, and in Lithuania, yeshiva was a place like that. I mean, I'm just wondering myself, here's the yeshiva guy reading the Kuzri, trying to figure out what the heck is going on. He's looking at the bottom, and there's a Gansa treatise on Cicero, or on Quintilian, or, you know, on Galen, or stuff like that. And, you know, who the heck are these guys? You understand? But that is the Italian Renaissance, right? That's that tkufa in Jewish history. It's very interesting. And so, you see, you know, Maskatza, I'll say it again, it's also in the Futsis Yehuda. You see a lot of this, you know, he's not simply quoting others. He's getting into their ideas. And he's using them in his own unique way. I'll say it for the 100th time, it's always from. He's always doing it, the Shem Shamayim, he's always doing it to reinforce some kind of from truth. You understand? And the reader is supposed to say, wow, this guy's so smart and everything. If he says the Torah is true, I guess it is. You know, that sort of approach. I get that, right? But it doesn't work so well today, which is probably why I haven't seen a Kuzri come out with a new printing of the Kol Yehuda, certainly not Manukat, because I can't imagine who the audience would be. Now, maybe I'm wrong. Listen, they came out Manukat, the drasha is on Mari Mintz, and what do you call it? Who's the other one? Medaber Yehuda from Leon and Modena. I mean, I don't know who these guys are. So you could do Nefutzas Yehuda also. But you see a very heavy amount of non-from stuff in it. Alongside, by the way, the Kol Yehuda is full of Shas and Tanakh. I mean, no question. And Midrashim. I mean, yes. And he always submissions together, you know, something from Shir HaShirim with, you know, with Quintilian, you know, something like that. And he's highly original in the way he approaches the Pesukim. He is very original in that. So if you take the trouble to go there, you'll come with a whole bunch of new, you know, ideas. Somebody could put out a book, like they did once for Azariah Figo, you know, the Parsha of the Week, or the Go Through the Tanakh, with the insights of the Kol Yehuda and the Nefutzas Yehuda. And you'd have some very interesting stuff. I don't see anybody, you know, willing to roll up their sleeves and plow through the material. At least that's my opinion. And so we're left with the idea that here we see the Renaissance at its best and its worst. It's most unlimited and most limited. On the one hand, you have this combination of Torah Derech Eretz by very good people who meant very well. On the other hand, you have the curse of rationalism, which is what makes... This is always the paradox of rationalism, that when you make the Torah make sense according to the science and the philosophy of your time, although people didn't realize it, a generation later, certainly a century later, it's going to seem out of date. Because what makes sense in the year 2024 will not make sense in the year 2124. And for all I know, in 2034, 2044. That's how the progress of human thinking goes. So when we read the Rambam today in the... You know, he says, this works out with Aristotelian philosophy. And like, today people say, what the heck is Aristotelian philosophy? And why should I care? Excuse me. Well, it works. Most of what Aristotle said, he got wrong anyway. So you have this objective versus subjective, relative versus non-relative factor that kicks in there. Having said that, the Kol Yehuda is definitely one of the classics of from literature and from Renaissance literature. I'll leave it at that. And anyway, I just wanted to share that idea. the Kuzri could, I mean, like I said before, now we have all these new translations, things like that. It could use a good Kahati type thing today, I would think. I'm not aware. I guess what this guy did, Ganesi, boils down to that, in my opinion. Anyway, there you have it. So I'm going to wrap it up. Not leaving Renaissance Italy yet, but I'm leaving Moscato. I want to thank Gideon for sponsoring three podcasts, especially for getting me all the latest scholarship on this. He knows how to do it in a way I don't. I want to thank everybody and wish you a good week.
For sponsorship opportunities or to support this podcast, please visit our donate page at www.support.rabbidovidkatz.com.